Okay, I'm here. This is Gary Parrish, and it is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. And I'm talking to you now on the morning of November 18th, which just happens to fall after a surprisingly interesting Sunday in college basketball. Melvin Edgem returned and helped Iowa State beat Michigan. Indiana State, of course, won at Notre Dame, and then Belmont upset North Carolina. So to help me talk about that and more, my colleagues at CBSSports.com, Matt Norlander and Jeff Borzello. Fellas, how are you on this Monday?
I'm doing great, well. Man.
Good morning, guys. That was surprisingly pretty good. College basketball's had two pretty good weekends in general, and then, of course, last week, which I'm sure we'll get into, and you in Chicago. Overall, I think it's been pretty solid.
Have we had typically, like, I was surprised, and, you know, I look at the schedule, so you remember, you notice these things when the schedule's released, and you forget about it, but as I'm looking into the weekend, I notice that, you know, Michigan is at Iowa State. Do we usually get, like, high-profile, non-conference, on-campus games this early like that?
Go ahead, Borzell, but I feel like it's only one or two.
Yeah, I feel like on-campus games we don't get. I mean, obviously we get like the preseason NIT and the Maui Invitational, but on-campus games between two probable maybe NCAA tournament teams, you know, I don't think we usually get that in the first 2 weeks of November.
Yeah, I feel like we get maybe one or two a year when it's on campus. Like, we obviously get plenty with all the exempt tournaments and all the stuff that November offers us and stuff like the Champions Classic in recent years. But to actually get two teams who I think they're surefire tournament teams, single-digit seeds at the worst, to get that within the first two weekends is terrific. And I wrote it on Sunday night. You know, before anything, I kind of credited John Beilein for taking a trip down to Iowa State. It's not the smartest thing to do in certain ways, but we benefit as writers, fans benefit when you get that kind of quality basketball this early, because, you know, we'll get that obviously in conference come January and February, but Michigan-Iowa State, it just seemed like such a random game for an on-campus spectacle, and look at Iowa State. They look really good, and Melvin coming back from that, we didn't even think he'd play in November, and he gets in the game yesterday, and he legitimizes his preseason all Big 12 standing. Meanwhile, Mitch McGarry coming back from that injured back, and back injuries can be so, I mean, you guys know this, I mean, they can be so nebulous. You just don't know when a back is fully healthy. McGarry looked decent, but obviously he's still knocking off some rust, and that was certainly a factor in Michigan falling short.
Yeah, we had, you know, that game on Sunday, and then earlier in the week, or I guess it's last week at this point, we had Arizona at San Diego State, which is, I don't think, as high profile, because San Diego State's missing, you know, some pieces from what they, but still, you know, Arizona going into a hostile environment. And, you know, listen, I love these neutral site events. Last Tuesday night in Chicago was terrific. I'm going to the Mohegan Sun this coming up weekend to see Louisville maybe just, you know, run all over a North Carolina team. And we'll get to that in a moment. But, you know, so I enjoy those as much as anybody else. But to me, college basketball is just so much better on a college campus. So I'm with you, man. You know, tip of the hat to Sean Miller at Arizona and to John Beilein at Michigan for putting their teams in hostile situations so early.
Yeah, I think some coaches kind of get it. Miller, actually, that game was on CBS Sports Network Thursday night, and I got home just in time to see the end of it. I actually had a bit of a music gig, and when I got home, Miller was talking about how he appreciates and likes to challenge his team. He takes a lot of pride in going on the road in a true hostile environment. San Diego State, which has remained relevant over the past 5 or 6 years, that is considered one of the toughest venues, certainly west of the Mississippi, to go in and play. The show, as they're called, the student section there, they really bring it, very funny, very creative. So I thought it was fantastic. And we got to see Aaron Gordon, who is not, in no way is this a forgotten freshman phenom, but he's considered the fourth member of maybe that Mount Rushmore for 2013-2014, along with Parker and Wiggins and Randall, and he looked pretty solid. And they're all playing tonight, which our former colleague Jeff Goodman tweeted. Actually, it's the first of five times during this regular season where all four will be on display tonight. So that'll be fun as well to see Gordon, and I think slowly but surely he'll get more pub because he's an athletic freak as well to go along with. We know what Wiggins can obviously do on the floor. We saw that last Tuesday.
You know what happened to Gordon is that, because I ran into this a little bit last week with Arizona fans, or at least people I presume to be Arizona fans, who were, you know, every time you'd mention Wiggins, Randall, or Jabari Parker, they'd say, well, what about Aaron Gordon? Well, what happened is you end up in all of these conversations leading up to the Champions Classic and then after the Champions Classic with people asking you specifically about the kids they just saw on national television. And that limits it to a three-player debate between Parker, Wiggins, and Randall. And sort of Aaron Gordon gets left on the outside of that, not because he doesn't belong in that class, because I think he does, but only because he didn't participate on that stage in Chicago. But he has, I think, started the season, you know, double-double, and he's just as terrific, or at least in the same class as those other kids. He wasn't on the stage with them on Tuesday night.
I think the other thing is that every time we mentioned Aaron Gordon in the preseason, it was whether he could play small forward or not. It was, oh, well, I don't think he could play small forward, or if he wants to be a small forward, can he do that in the NBA? And so I just think that was, every time we mentioned him, that was always the kind of the caveat, can he play small? There was always that question surrounding him. We didn't really have those about Julius Randle or Jabari Parker, and you know, Goodman's the only one that had him about Andrew Wiggins. So it was, yeah, I think it was just kind of a different narrative surrounding Aaron Gordon heading into the season.
Well, listen, on Sunday, so you know, Iowa State's win was obviously significant. Indiana State going to Notre Dame was obviously significant. But the story of the day, to the extent that there was a story of the day that didn't involve the NFL, I think was probably Belmont winning at North Carolina. Like we've known that North Carolina is shorthanded, but still, it's the Tar Heels and it's Roy Williams and it's at the Dean Smith Center, and they are quite simply not supposed to lose to an Ohio Valley Conference school. I wrote very quickly and with just a few hundred words yesterday about this. And then one of you guys, I don't know who it was, but one of you was on the IO.
It was
college.
Me. Okay, it was me. Let's have it out here, GP. Let's
okay, you're right. I knew it. By the way, I knew it was you. I was just going to leave it open-ended for a second. I could always tell who's tweeting from that account just by the words that are used and the tone of you guys. It's so funny. I don't need to read like a Norlander column or a Borzello column, and I recognize that you could apply the same thing to me to know who's writing it. I just need 140 characters, and I can tell who's who. So I write about North Carolina losing at home to Belmont, and Norlander tweets it out from the Ion College Basketball Podcast with a, quote, kinda bad loss for North Carolina. What are you talking about, kinda bad? When you're North Carolina and you lose to an OVC school that at home, that's undeniably bad.
Okay, here's the deal. It's I put kinda in parentheses next to bad because there are two factors at play here. One, Carolina's without PJ Harrison, Leslie McDonald.
Got it.
I feel if they were on the floor, they wouldn't have lost. And Belmont.
Don't tell me how good Belmont is, because I'm about to hit
come
you.
Come on, not deny how solid Belmont has been over the past six, 7 years.
Yeah, you ready? You ready? Here's how solid. Here's how solid. I don't know. I'll tell you how solid they've been over the past 6 or 7 years. I'll tell you how solid they've been over the past 10. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday was the first top 25 team they've beaten since December 2003. That's okay. How solid.
They're also not even the favorite in their own conference this year.
That's how solid.
And they're not even expected to be that good. I think it speaks to Rick's coaching ability. He's considered one of the 5 to 10 best coaches in all of college basketball in terms of strategy. So
come on, man. Listen, I love Rick Byrd, but you didn't just put okay, let's say 5, all right? You ready? I'm gonna start. Krzyzewski, Izzo, Self, Calipari, Sean Miller. Now go ahead. Tell me which one of those you're taking out to put in Rick Byrd. Norlander, tell me which one of those you're taking out to put in Rick Byrd.
X and O's, I take out Calipari.
Are you just took Rick Byrd over John Calipari. Hold on, let me pause right here. At the 8:34 mark of this podcast on November 18th, Matt Norlander substituted Rick Byrd for John substituted Rick Byrd and John Calipari. Kentucky fans, let him have it.
Got that right. Now listen, I'm just talking strictly from the whiteboard standpoint. I think a lot of coaches would say that as well. Now Calipari can coach, and he actually has been wrongfully dismissed as
one who just dismissed him. Don't talk about wrongly. You're the one who just did it.
Can we talk in matters of perspective here, GP? I mean, honestly.
He's talking the whiteboard, man.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Nerdlander. Talk about the whiteboard.
Hey, listen, I'm just saying that Byrd is a really talented coach.
Nobody disputes that.
Okay. And all right, so hold on, here's my thing. What was the worst loss? UNC to Belmont or Oregon State to Coppin State?
What are you even talking? Who cares about Oregon State and Coppin State?
Just asking.
I don't know. North Carolina should never lose to an OVC school. I'll take that as the worst loss.
But it doesn't matter. Like, you're not factoring in that Hairston wasn't in and McDonald wasn't in.
I'm factoring in that it's North Carolina playing at the Dean Smith Center against an OVC school that hasn't beat a top 25 team despite all of its success and its top five coach in the world, according to you, in a decade. That's what I'm factoring in.
Well, I'll go top 10. Let's just be clear here.
Fine. I'll continue my list. Jim Boeheim. You ready to keep going? I mean, listen, I could do that. Listen, let me be clear.
You can name off all these terrific coaches. I'm not going to dispute that. I'm going to say within the college coaching fraternity, Rick Byrd is considered one of the best X and O coaches in the game. That's not my opinion. That's the opinion of coaches.
Well, you're now qualifying your statement as best X's and O's. I mean, I guess we can go find a high school coach who's really good on X's and O's, too. But when you say one of the top five college basketball coaches. That's crazy. And let me be clear. I love Rick Byrd. I think he's terrific. But I think it has become, because I've had to address this in the poll attacks multiple times over the past few years. It becomes like Belmont goes on some 15 game winning streak in the league, and people go, "Oh my God, Belmont's really good, really good." And then they go in the NCAA tournament and they lose in the first round, which is what they've done every single time. Every single time.
I did a story on that very thing last year when they blew it in the round of 64, and it's a reputation that's well earned and something that they'll have to overcome. Now, my question to you is, how bad do you think this is for Carolina? Do you think this is something that's going to clearly have some lingering effects because you don't expect Hairston or McDonald to be back anytime soon? Is Carolina not even top 40 good because of this loss?
I don't think they're very good right now.
I don't either.
I mean, I had them, I think, like 19 going into the season, and that was assuming Hairston and McDonald come back soon. And it just doesn't – I don't know if they are. There's no word on them. There's been no update on them. And without those two, I don't know if they're an NCAA tournament team. I mean, they have McAdoo and Marcus Page and a bunch of role players. They're talented role players, but they haven't done anything yet. And just relying on Page and McAdoo, I don't think that's an NCAA tournament team.
What concerns me, actually, is that even when they get Hairston McDonald back, like, how good are their other guys? Other guys good enough to make them, you know, I don't know, Carolina good? I mean, listen, they can be good. And I think they will be fine, like, in terms of I would predict them to make the NCAA tournament even without Hairston. I don't think McDonald's going to miss the whole year. I recognize Hairston at this point is very much up in the air. People will tweet you every single day telling you he's not coming back, GP. You got to stop waiting on that. And I recognize that theory exists right now. But as we're speaking at this moment, nothing is official about PJ Hairston. Although I understand that a lot of people don't think he's going to be back for quite some time, if at all. But even with Hairston and McDonald, I'm not sure if their ceiling is as high as maybe some of us, and I include me in this because I might have got it wrong, predicted in the preseason. All of that said, and I do want to be serious because I was joking around about Belmont a minute ago. All of that, like, Belmont is a very, very, very good, you know, so-called mid-major program that is rock solid and well-coached and all of that. But the reality is they don't beat people like North Carolina, and they haven't beat people like North Carolina for the past decade. Sundays win over a ranked team was their first since December 2003. That's significant. So, despite, you know, Rick Byrd's stature in coaching circles, and let me be clear, I think he's a terrific basketball coach as well. That program isn't supposed to go into the Dean Smith Center and win regardless of whether PJ Hairston is there or Leslie McDonald was there. That was a bad and on some level humbling and humiliating loss for Carolina that I know that fan base is probably concerned about, because in a week, theoretically, they're supposed to have a showdown at the Mohegan Sun with Louisville. Now it doesn't look like it's going to be a showdown, but B, I'm not even sure it's going to happen because they got to beat Richmond on Saturday first. And are we certain they're going to be able to do that?
Yeah. First of all, I do agree basically with the overall thesis of your statement there, GP. Belmont should not go into UNC and win. Generally speaking, Richmond, I agree. That's a solid team. Beat Belmont, by the way, 2-1. I think the Spiders are very solid, and you're going to that, right? I mean, you kind of booked that trip thinking that Carolina would be, you know, mostly Carolina, and we'd get a Carolina Louisville final, and we might still, but no guarantee there. This will be an interesting one to track because the ACC in general had a really bad Sunday. I mean, Boston College barely escaped at home against Florida Atlantic. We mentioned the Notre Dame loss to Indiana State. Carolina losing. Who's the third one, guys, that I'm forgetting about? There was an ACC team that lost. There was a third one.
There was Maryland.
Maryland dropped. Yeah, Maryland dropped one at home to Oregon State in front of the Obama. So Carolina, how they perform, I wonder if that, you know, to a certain degree might mimic or just be a barometer for how the ACC is this year, because we thought that this was going to be the best league. I still think it actually will be at the end of the day. I think when we get to March, I'm expecting that league to have the most bids and to have the most teams in that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 seed range. But certainly concerns about Carolina, and just, you know, I don't want to take one day and three results and overreact too much to a league. But I think there was just a little bit of rightful criticism against the ACC for having such a stinker of a Sunday.
And don't forget that earlier in the week, Duke lost to Kansas. Now, there's no shame in losing to Kansas, but Duke was favored on a neutral court, and that's the ACC favorite, you know, losing early in the season as well. So again, not embarrassing, but you know, it is notable. They have a check in the loss column right now.
Yeah, and heck of a week for Duke, by the way. I tweeted this out. I mean, Parker, they lost to Kansas, but Parker was, in my opinion, the most impressive all around. Randall was so awesome as well, but he did have those 8 turnovers. So you had Parker, then you had Friday, which I'm sure we're going to get into, and them landing Okafor and Tyus Jones, what, number 1, number 4 overall recruits. Football beats Miami at home. Football's now ranked, and then Carolina lost. So it was a banner week for Duke in general.
Well, let's get into that recruiting thing right now before we go any further. Barzello, you've seen Jahlil Okafor and Tyus Jones more than the both of us, although Norlander and I have both seen them as well. People are forever going to ask, the same way they did with Wiggins, Randall, Parker, Gordon, Vonleh, all of these kids, you know, so how are they going to be? What are they like? Who do they remind you of? Let's break that down. Jahlil Okafor, Tyus Jones, how good are they going to be right from the start at Duke?
Well, I think Okafor immediately becomes the best post player in the country. I'm assuming Randall goes
sure.
pro. And even if he doesn't, I mean, Okafor, with his back-to-the-basket game, he's probably the best, you know, back-to-the-basket post player we've seen in a really long time. Some people have said since DeMarcus Cousins. You know, and then Tyus Jones, he's not going to be the explosive point guard that, you know, Andrew Harrison is or Emmanuel Mudiay is, kid going to SMU. But, you know, he's smart. He knows how to run an offense. He's got great chemistry with Okafor. And these are two kids that didn't play high school together, AAU together. They just became best of friends through USA Basketball in these elite camps. And I just think with those two, I think Duke becomes the national title favorite just because of that inside-outside combo. Regardless of whether Parker goes pro or Rodney Hood goes pro, I just think that with those two, when you have one of the top 3 point guards and the best post player in the country, you're going to win most nights.
Norlander, let me ask you about something Barzello just said, which is, you know, they weren't AAU teammates. They weren't high school teammates. They were just friends who met over the summers and decided to go play together. I wrote a column on Friday sort of comparing this, very loosely, I acknowledge, but to the decision that LeBron made in 2010, which was, you know, he didn't obviously grow up with Dwayne Wade or Chris Bosh, but they met each other and became friends over the summers and then decided they would be willing as a trio to, quote, share the spotlight in the pursuit of championships. And I wondered, again, just sort of hypothetically, if that had impacted, you know, the prep level, because everything that happens at the NBA level seems to trickle down. And I immediately had a lot of fans say, one had nothing to do with the other, which, you know, typically on Twitter, people are going to just, you know, they're just there to dismiss whatever it is you say, no matter what. Like, I get that. But they compared it to the Fab Five. They even compared it to, they said, oh, well, what about Mike Conley and Greg Oden or DeMarcus Cousins and John Wall? And I tried to explain that the difference between these things is Wall and Cousins didn't decide they were going to play together and then pick a school. They just happened to pick the same school. Mike Conley and Greg Oden were high school teammates or AAU teammates. They were friends growing up who decided to play together, but that's different. This was the first time, at least that I could think of, that we've had two guys from completely different parts of the country who never played together in AAU and never played together in high school decide to make a decision. Do you think, A, I was at least on to something in theory about what I wrote, and B, if this is something that we'll continue to see down the road, particularly if it works out in terms of a national championship for Okafor and Jones?
I thought it was a quintessential Parrish column in a good way, just because you have a knack for, and you know, sorry for the theoretical back massage I'm giving you here, but you have a knack for kind of catching on to something before that's kind of obvious, but yet people don't hit on it. I thought it was right on the money, and this was always a fascinating thing to me, that Okafor, because when I first heard about the probability of this happening, naturally I assumed they went to the same high school, and then I found out they were nowhere even near each other. I thought it was very fascinating the way that they're friendship kind of develop naturally. I think it'll be a story written about plenty once they get to college. I don't know how common it will be going forward. I personally, for college basketball, I'd love to see it, just because when you have elite talent, that's one, when you have these kind of players that are willing to do this at this level, because you got a lot of guys like Cliff Alexander said, I'm not going to go play where Jahlil Okafor is going to play. And I get that, because if you're similar positions, you know, you're battling for playing time and draft stock and all that stuff. But when you can have guys like this that are willing to team up and just have a genuine friendship that kind of transcends basketball, then the basketball end of it, we benefit from it, because then you're going to naturally have those players who are high in the rankings go to really good teams, make them more interesting inherently. And given their relationship and their dynamic, you'd assume that that they'll work together on the basketball court as is and make those teams better. I think it'll be very good for Duke, who, by the way, I mean, I picked them to win the title this year. Who knows if that'll happen or not. But now, I mean, Krzyzewski at this age, I mean, he is just cooking with gas. I mean, just we had talked over the summer about, you know, when might these guys step down and leave? And, you know, that discussion can still be had plenty down the road. But I just, with the Olympic basketball, and we don't really need to get off on this, I'm kind of just vamping. Like, Krzyzewski is as hot now as he's ever been.
It's wild, because and I wrote about this in the preseason. There are five active Hall of Fame coaches in college basketball right now. Mike is one, Jim Boeheim's another, Roy Williams is another, Rick Pitino is the fourth, and then Larry Brown's the fifth. And four of those guys are obviously operating at top tier programs right now. And what's interesting is they're all still operating at like the highest levels, both on and off the court. Now, I recognize Roy just took a loss over the weekend to Belmont, and he'll have to figure that out. But in terms of recruiting, Brazillo, correct me if I'm wrong, they've got three top 25 kids committed right now, correct?
Yeah, I mean, before the package deal and Kentucky getting a couple of kids a few weeks ago, they were the number one class in the country.
Right.
And people forget about them because they committed so long ago and say, oh, well, why isn't Roy Williams getting kids? Well, they already have. They've had three kids locked up for several months now.
Yeah, and so like you look at Pitino, Roy, Boeheim, and as you were talking about Norlander, Mike Krzyzewski, you know, this isn't like Joe Paterno, where you've got this iconic coach on campus and he's getting, you know, advancing in age, and it's a delicate situation where you got to figure out, okay, you can't fire the guy, but how do you ease him out to get to rebuild your program and sort of start that transition, or like what Florida State was dealing with for several years with Bobby Bowden. These guys are all into their 60s and all still operating, you know, at the highest of levels, both on and off the court. It's pretty remarkable, and you know, nobody is doing it better right now than Mike Krzyzewski, and a lot of that has to do with USA Basketball. Borzello, you're into the recruiting more so than the you know, Norlander and I. Tell me, how much does it have to do with Jeff Capel being back on staff?
I think it has a lot. I mean, he's been a ace recruiter for him.
Right.
He's another guy with head coaching experience. He relates to the kids well, and he's one of the you know, when you see most assistant coaches out on the recruiting circuit, you know, a lot of them are recognizable. I wouldn't say most are, but kids will recognize who Jeff Capel is. And, you know, when he's sitting there watching game, you know he's a Duke assistant. You know who he is, and you can't say the same. You can't say that for every high major assistant coach, but you could certainly say it for Jeff Capel. And I think that you mentioned the USA Basketball. I think that's a huge plus for Krzyzewski. I mean, he gets to work with these kids. You know, they come and they watch, you know, LeBron and those guys scrimmage in the summer. And, you know, when these kids are watching the Olympics or the World Championships or whatever, and they're seeing Krzyzewski coach LeBron and stuff like that, you know, it's kind of, you know, I don't know if these kids are ever in awe of really anything anymore, but when you see, you know, one coach getting all these guys, LeBron and Kobe, to play together, I think kids are impressed by that, and I think that's a huge factor when he's landing these five-star elite guys.
The other thing I think is interesting, and I'm not suggesting that Kay would ever use a hammer like this, but it's got to be in the back of some recruit's mind somewhere, particularly, you know, intelligent recruits like Tyus Jones, who's a sharp kid, who look, you know, down the road. And, you know, if you're ever interested in winning a gold medal, if you're ever interested in playing in the Olympics, do you really want to go ahead and reject the guy who, you know, could theoretically be in charge of that decision or have major influence over that decision down the road. I mean, I can only put it, you know, in our lives, in our professions, we're all sports writers, right? Well, I don't think any of us would ever want to burn a bridge with, you know, a possible employer down the road, just because you never know where you're going to be at in your life. And I got to think that that factors into at least somebody's decision when they're picking between Duke and somebody else. I got to think that it at least enters your mind. Listen, this is the guy in, you know, basically running USA Basketball. I think it's reasonable to suggest that Kay's the most powerful person in basketball, pro or college level, like in terms of power in the sport.
Right.
That
makes sense.
And do you really want to reject that guy? Does that make sense, Norlander?
It makes sense. There are so many different avenues that being with USA Basketball benefits Mike Krzyzewski. It's even I remember last year. I mean, even when he's not there. Oh, he's not here because, by the way, he's coaching the Olympic team, so he can't be on the recruiting trail. That kind of stuff has such impact and power. I never saw Krzyzewski as in any way becoming irrelevant, but I did not foresee him becoming this powerful, and he is on a path right now, and especially if he gets one more, because no one's going to match what Wooden did. It was a different era, but if he gets to that fifth national title, you combine that with what he's done with the Olympic team, and let's just presume that his next one will be his last one, and he'll win a gold again. I mean, there is really, really a case to be made that he could be the best basketball coach of all time, considering he'll have all-time wins record in college hoops. He'll have done what he's done at the Olympic level. And I think it'd be good for college basketball just because he'll have said, you know, he almost took the Lakers job, what was it, 04 or whatnot? But he didn't necessarily need that. I think it speaks volumes for him. Real quick, I wanted just to ask you guys what we thought about Cliff Alexander, not to take kind of a right turn here. But that was, like, clearly the biggest reaction over the weekend of anything. Like, Duke did a great job landing the top two recruits. But Alexander pump-faking Illinois fans and picking up that hat and then dropping it for Kansas. I mean, this obviously lit a firestorm. Some people said he's 18, let it go. Others people are like, no, he knows what he's doing. He's been going through this process for 2 years. You know how much that meant to Illinois fans and need to be more mature about it. I'm kind of torn. I kind of lean toward he should have known what he was doing, but at the same time, we were all 18 and we were all idiots, right?
Well, listen, okay, I'm on the side of he's 18, let it go, right? Because, listen, when I was 18, I would have been an idiot. Hell, let's be honest, I'm 36, I'm kind of an idiot, all right? So I would write it off as it's a kid being a kid, possibly a dumb kid being a dumb kid. That said, I don't think you gain anything if you're Cliff Alexander from pump faking your home state fan base. It's a bad look. And if I were his parents, right? If my son were in that same position, we would have sat down. And once my son told me, Dad, I'm going to go to Kansas and not Illinois, I'd have said, that's cool. That's awesome. You're going to be great there. But here's what we're going to do at the press conference. First out, we ain't pump faking anybody. And secondly, we are going to be overly complimentary to John Gross and to Illinois, because I have to live here and you got to come back here. This is always going to be your home and I don't want it to be uncomfortable. It's, you know, there are going to be some Illinois fans that are going to despise you just because you didn't pick Illinois. That's the nature of this stuff. But to pour gas on the fire, so to speak, with that, it's just a bad look. I don't blame Cliff because Cliff's a kid, you know, but his parents should have probably talked to him about that in advance. I know I would have.
Right. I mean, and news started to kind of trickle out a little bit on Friday afternoon that he was going to pick Kansas. And Illinois fans seemed upset, you know, always the bridesmaid. We always miss out on these kids. But nobody seemed to really, you know, vehemently hate Cliff Alexander. When he pump faked the hat, that took it to a new level. I mean, they despise him now. He said, like, he knew what he was doing. I mean, some people said, oh, maybe he did it by accident. No, he said a teammate kind of, like, mentioned it to him. He's like, oh, let's do it. And I just think, you know, it was stupid. I get he was having fun, but I think it was a bad move.
It's one thing to, like, if you are picking, and he was, like, at least, you know, on the surface, picking between Illinois, Kansas, Memphis, and DePaul, although I think we all knew it was basically between Kansas and Illinois. It's one thing if everybody thought it was between Memphis and Kansas, and he picks up a Memphis hat and then puts it down. You don't have – like, Memphis fans would be pissed, but so what? You know, he probably will never be in Memphis except for the times he's playing against the Memphis Grizzlies. So it's not a – someday. So it's not a big deal. But to do that to your home state – that, you know, to the place right. you're going to return for the rest of your life. I just think that's something I would predict this. There will be a day, whether it's next week, 5 years from now, there will be a day where Cliff Alexander is asked about that. A more mature Cliff Alexander will be asked about that, and he will acknowledge that he regrets doing it.
I think he said on Friday that he shouldn't have done it.
Okay.
Well, yeah, because I mean,
I think he might have said that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But just a few things here. One, it reminds me of LeBron leaving. Okay. I mean, obviously not nearly the same scale, but you got a home state situation, a fan base just kind of hanging on your every word, and just the ultimate teaser and ultimate heartbreak. Okay. Now I wonder if he's, you know, the most recent example of Illinois fans feeling shafted was Gordon, 6 years ago when he chose to go to Indiana. I think this now trumps that. This will certainly, even after the problem is after he apologizes, it's still a story because now that ESPN News got the video and forevermore when he plays next year, that is going to be what we reference until he does something amazing. And he is an amazing player. I mean, he is, by the way,
he's a man.
Beast of a freak of a player. I loved watching him this past summer. So all this recent stuff aside, like, he is going to be so much fun to watch play at Kansas, and Self is rolling as well. And by the way, I wanted to ask you guys, because I did not even know or remember this, but apparently the first time this ever happened, anyone can ever remember, was when Baron Davis did it like 15 years ago. So apparently he started the trend. I had no idea, but in mentioning it on Friday when he did it, people said it was kind of Baron Davis reincarnated, but I had no idea that that Davis had initially started
this.
Yeah,
I don't have any recollection of that. I would just say for all recruits, like, it's just because this stuff is followed so heavily and intensely, you know, these days, I don't think you gain anything by rubbing it in other fan bases' face. I think you for whatever shock effect and joke and laughs you might get from a very small segment of the population, you're needlessly pissing people off. And I don't, though I recognize some people would say, Parrish, that's what you do every day. I would disagree, but to the point, I would say it's I wouldn't do it.
And plus, you know, people, I guess, you know, once Alexander did the Kansas-Illinois thing, people forgot that, well, I guess Illinois fans didn't forget, that morning they lost their point guard, their top 30, top 40 point guard. He is originally, Quentin Snyder was originally a Louisville commit, decommitted, committed to Illinois, and then on Friday morning, he decided to sign a letter of intent to go to Louisville, didn't tell the Illinois staff until after he signed a letter of intent. And I just, you know, that the Cliff Alexander pump fake in the Illinois hat, you know, the Illinois fans were obviously already on edge the whole day, and I think that just set them off. So, you know, I think Cliff Alexander probably should have read the situation a little bit better.
Let's advance from what happened on Friday to Sunday. We've already talked about, you know, Indiana State winning, or at least noted, winning at Notre Dame. We've talked about Iowa State knocking off Michigan. We've talked about Belmont winning at North Carolina. We also had history on Sunday at Rupp Arena. No, not only that Kentucky avenged last season's NIT loss to Robert Morris. I think the final was like 87-49. But the Wildcats started five freshmen for the first time in school history. You know, I don't know whether Willie Cauley-Stein gets back in the starting lineup, because I turned the game on. Like, I think they'd already played a minute by the time I got there. But, like, when I turned the game on, Willie Cauley-Stein was already in the game. So, like, he checked in pretty quickly. But I just wonder, do you guys think this Fab Five thing in Lexington is going to catch on?
Go ahead, Brazil.
I mean, I don't think it will. I just think, because Cauley-Stein, I just think he's going to be the guy that gets the 29, 30 minutes at center. But it's kind of a cool talking point. And Calipari, I doubt he was serious. He said that he started Lee because Cauley-Stein doesn't win tip-offs, but
that's classic Cal, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think it's kind of a cool talking point. I don't think it'll last when they play against, you know, better teams, but you know, they have the talent to do it. And if there's one team in the country that can pull it off, it's Kentucky.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what becomes of that. It wouldn't surprise me if we did that. And then Calipari can also say, hey, we had a first-round pick. Cauley-Stein will probably go first round. I mean, some think he can be lottery. We'll see what he can do. He shows flashes, and then he has a tendency to disappear. But, I mean, GP knows this as well or better than anyone in terms of Calipari's tendencies as a coach, why he does certain things for certain different reasons. I wouldn't shock me if he went five freshmen for whether it was tactical and legitimate X and O reasons, to circle back to what we talked about earlier, or if it's to send a message to his team at this early point in the season. Kentucky forever fascinates me because of what Calipari is able to do with that talent and how they win. You just knew they'd mop the floor. You know, when they're awesome, they're Bob Morris, and when they lose, they're Robert Morris. And certainly Robert Morris showed up on Sunday, and that was no real shocker there. But coming off what they did Tuesday, where they looked good and people were saying, you know, Randall had 8 turnovers and they played that bad and they only lost by 5. That must mean they're going to be awesome come February. Well, that's probably the case, but it doesn't mean they still can't lose. So I still think we've got, you know, the invariable situation that we get every November with Kentucky. You know, they've got a very young team. Cal's going to tinker as he needs to see fit, and there's no perfect solution right now. But if it's 5 freshmen, well, then that's obviously another storyline for us to talk and write about, and it just might very well work.
Listen, if John starts 5 freshmen, it'll be either because A, he thinks it's the best thing for his team, B, for some sort of motivating factor, yeah, or C, as a recruiting pitch so that he can forever tell, you know, prospects, you know, I'll start 5 freshmen if I have to, and it doesn't matter if I've got a lottery pick as a sophomore who returned. If he's not good enough, then I'll start somebody over him, so don't worry about coming to Kentucky and playing behind a, quote, lottery pick, because I showed, you know, within the first 2 weeks of the 2013-14 season that I'm willing to put that guy on the bench if he's not performing or if you are. So
he can also flip it and say, you know, you might not start, but I've had first-round picks come off the bench. So
right.
You'll be fine either way.
Right. So my point is, it'll be for any of those reasons. It'll never be because of a jump ball or anything.
No, I know.
Or anything like that. Hey, also, Jack Taylor got 109 on Sunday. Are you guys fed up with this story? Like, I saw that, so I immediately posted it just because I recognize that's the type of thing that people will click on. But I can't tell you how many people tweeted at me and said, is this really a story? Well, in the world I live in, anything that people's going to read is a story, and that's something people are going to read. But are you over it, Jack Taylor scoring 100 for the second time in less than a year?
I think it's a story because, I mean, I haven't listened to any national radio or watched SportsCenter today, but I've got to believe he's getting a mention in some sort. And if that's happening, then yeah, it's a story. I don't know who tweeted it out, but someone made a really good point that apparently, like, his team press release quotes, you know, he kind of thanked the team for letting him, you know, be part of the, or I don't, it was something where he had mentioned it was a team effort, and yet he shot, like, I mean, God knows how many 3-pointers.
48. He was, like, but how about this? Yeah. I get it, but, like, how about this? Okay, fine. So it's gimmicky, and they're sort of funneling the ball to him to let him make a run at this type of thing. Still, if you hit 24 or 48 3-pointers, if you shoot 48 3-pointers and make 50% of them, that's pretty damn impressive.
It is.
Yeah, but I think it's certainly worth the headline. I think it's kind of a cool story, but I think when he did it last year, we talked about it for, like, 4 days after.
Right.
And I got tired of it then. If it ends by, you know, this afternoon, I'll be fine with it, because it's a cool story.
Here's the cynical side of it all. So, one, I want to know, because he scored, like, what, 79 4 days ago or something like that, 72? Okay.
Yeah, 70, like, 90 games.
I didn't do a deep dive research before the podcast. I want to know how good these two teams he did it against. Because remember, last year when he put up 138 and set the all-time record, it was against, like, a church league team, basically, a glorified church league team. So how good was the competition? And are they doing this again so they can kind of bake themselves into the news cycle, which isn't dumb on behalf of Grinnell that's doing this and making Jack Taylor, the most ordinary sounding name, become a household name in college basketball. But am I over it? Not yet, but I'm on the borderline. But I do wonder if they're going to try and intentionally do this where he's going to try and average, you know, is he going to try and set the record here and average 71 in a game per season? I don't know what's going on there.
All right, last thing before I let you guys go. The Associated Press poll, coaches poll, they should be updating on Monday afternoon. Not should be. They absolutely will. But I suspect Michigan State's going to be number one, if only because Michigan State was number two last week and then Michigan State beat number one. And knowing the way polls typically work, that's going to push them into the number one spot. Who should be number one, Bortello? Michigan State, Louisville, or Kansas?
I mean, I think Louisville, just because I had them number two behind Kentucky going into the year.
Sure.
They're still my national title pick. And they haven't done anything, in my opinion, to lose that spot. And I think, obviously, I think they're getting better with Bahannon and Hancock coming back maybe earlier than expected. So I think they should be the number one team. But that's just because I had them right behind Kentucky. If you had Michigan State behind Kentucky, they should be number one.
Yeah, I would say Louisville as well, only because the first few weeks in November, we kind of get a decent litmus test on what these teams are, and I feel like there can be a little bit more fluctuation near the top than we're going to get in January when we have, obviously, 15 to 20 games behind us, and we really can get a good idea of what these teams are. Michigan State did really struggle against Columbia, got the win. But with Louisville now being full strength, which they weren't at the start of the year, with Bahannon back and Hancock being mixed into the fold, I guess I would take them barely over Michigan State, but it's really close. I find it kind of interesting that we've got this cluster at the top here, guys, five or six teams, which I hope we have for the whole year.
I'll say that if in January, that's when the early January is kind of when I start ranking teams based on what they've actually done resume-wise. So I think Michigan State obviously has a better resume than Louisville right now. So in January, I put them number one. But I think in kind of the early season, as you mentioned, Norlander, you kind of just base it on what a team looks like, what they looked like beginning, going into the season. And I kind of now I would rank them based on talent. In January, that's when I start ranking them based on kind of a resume.
I think that's fair. All right. Well, listen, we've been talking long enough, I think. So let me wrap this up by telling Jeff Porzello and Matt Norlander, thanks for being here again. And by telling you guys listening, thanks for listening. We really do appreciate you being here at CBSSports.com. Listen to the podcast, reading what we write, interacting with us on Twitter. And remember, you can subscribe to the Eye on College Basketball podcast over on iTunes, so make sure you do that. It's honestly, I believe this is true, the quickest way to get your hands on the latest podcast. So go subscribe at iTunes. It's free, and either way, I'll talk to you again later on this week. Take care.